Chapter 81. Make the most of her stock. My guardian, being as pleased with the idea as Caddy was, we took her home next day to arrange the matter, and brought her out again in triumph with her boxes and all the purchases that could be squeezed out of a £10 note, which Mr. Jellyby had found in the docks, I suppose, but which he at all events gave her. What my guardian would not have given her, if we had encouraged him, it would be difficult to say, but we thought it right to compound for no more than her wedding dress and bonnet. He agreed to this compromise, and if Caddy had ever been happy in her life, she was happy when we sat down to work. She was clumsy enough with her needle, poor girl, and pricked her fingers as much as she had been used to ink them. She could not help reddening a little now and then, partly with the smart, and partly with vexation at being able to do no better, but she soon got over that, and began to improve rapidly. So day after day she, and my darling, and my little maid Charlie, and a milliner out of the town, and I, sat hard at work, as pleasantly as possible. Over and above this, Caddy was very anxious to learn housekeeping, as she said. Now, mercy upon us. The idea of her learning housekeeping of a person of my vast experience was such a joke that I laughed, and colored up, and fell into a comical confusion when she proposed it. However, I said, Caddy, I am sure you are very welcome to learn anything that you can learn of me, my dear, and I showed her all my books and methods and all my fidgety ways. You would have supposed that I was showing her some wonderful inventions by her study of them, and if you had seen her, whenever I jingled my housekeeping keys, get up and attend me, certainly you might have thought that there never was a greater impostor than I with a blinder follower than Caddy Jellyby. So what with working and housekeeping, and lessons to Charlie, and backgammon in the evening with my guardian, and duets with Ada, the 3 weeks slipped fast away. Then I went home with Caddy, to see what could be done there, and Ada and Charlie remained behind to take care of my guardian. When I say I went home with Caddy, I mean to the furnished lodging in Hatton Garden. We went to Newman Street 2 or 3 times, where preparations were in progress to a good many, I observed, for enhancing the comforts of old Mr. Turveydrop, and a few for putting the newly married couple away cheaply at the top of the house, but our great point was to make the furnished lodging decent for the wedding breakfast, and to imbue Mrs. Jellyby beforehand with some faint sense of the occasion. The latter was the more difficult thing of the two, because Mrs. Jellyby and an unwholesome boy occupied the front sitting room, the back one was a mere closet, and it was littered down with waste paper and Borubilin documents, as an untidy stable might be littered with straw. Mrs. Jellyby sat there all day drinking strong coffee, dictating, and holding Borubilin interviews by appointment. The unwholesome boy, who seemed to me to be going into a decline, took his meals out of the house. When Mr. Jellyby came home, he usually groaned and went down into the kitchen. There he got something to eat, if the servant would give him anything, and then, feeling that he was in the way, went out and walked about Hatton Garden in the wet. The poor children scrambled up and tumbled down the house as they had always been accustomed to do. The production of these devoted little sacrifices in any presentable condition being quite out of the question at a week's notice, I proposed to Caddy that we should make them as happy as we could on her marriage morning in the attic where they all slept, and should confine our greatest efforts to her mama and her mama's room, and a clean breakfast. In truth, Mrs. Jellyby required a good deal of attention, the lattice work up her back having widened considerably since I first knew her, and her hair looking like the mane of a dustman's horse. Thinking that the display of Caddy's wardrobe would be the best means of approaching the subject, I invited Mrs. Jellyby to come and look at it spread out on Caddy's bed in the evening after the unwholesome boy was gone. My dear Miss Summerson, said she, rising from her desk with her usual sweetness of temper, these are really ridiculous preparations, though your assisting them is a proof of your kindness. There is something so inexpressibly absurd to me in the idea of Caddy being married. Oh, Patty, you silly, silly, silly puss. She came upstairs with us notwithstanding, and looked at the clothes in her customary far-off manner. They suggested one distinct idea to her, for she said with her placid smile, and shaking her head, "My good Miss Summerson, at half the cost, this weak child might have been equipped for Africa." On our going downstairs again, Mrs. Jellyby asked me whether this troublesome business was really to take place next Wednesday. And on my replying yes, she said, "Will my room be required, my dear Miss Summerson? For it's quite impossible that I can put my papers away." I took the liberty of saying that the room would certainly be wanted, and that I thought we must put the papers away somewhere. "Well, my dear Miss Summerson," said Mrs. Jellyby, "you know best, I dare say. But by obliging me to employ a boy, Caddy has embarrassed me to that extent, overwhelmed as I am with public business, that I don't know which way to turn. We have a ramification meeting too, on Wednesday afternoon, and the inconvenience is very serious." "It is not likely to occur again," said I, smiling. "Caddy will be married but once, probably." "That's true," Mrs. Jellyby replied. "That's true, my dear. I suppose we must make the best of it." The next question was how Mrs. Jellyby should be dressed on the occasion. I thought it very curious to see her looking on serenely from her writing table, while Caddy and I discussed it, occasionally shaking her head at us with a half-reproachful smile like a superior spirit who could just bear with our trifling. The state in which her dresses were, and the extraordinary confusion in which she kept them, added not a little to our difficulty, but at length we devised something not very unlike what a commonplace mother might wear on such an occasion. The abstracted manner in which Mrs. Jellyby would deliver herself up to having this attire tried on by the dressmaker, and the sweetness with which she would then observe to me how sorry she was that I had not turned my thoughts to Africa, were consistent with the rest of her behavior. The lodging was rather confined as to space, but I fancied that, if Mrs. Jellyby's household had been the only lodgers in St. Paul's or St. Peter's, the sole advantage they would have found in the size of the building would have been its affording a great deal of room to be dirty in. I believe that nothing belonging to the family which it had been possible to break was unbroken at the time of those preparations for Caddy's marriage, that nothing which it had been possible to spoil in any way was unspoiled, and that no domestic object which was capable of collecting dirt, from a dear child's knee to the door plate, was without as much dirt as could well accumulate upon it. Poor Mr. Jellyby, who very seldom spoke, and almost always sat, when he was at home with his head against the wall, became interested when he saw that Caddy and I were attempting to establish some order among all this waste and ruin, and took off his coat to help. But such wonderful things came tumbling out of the closets, when they were opened: bits of moldy pie, sour bottles, Mrs. Jellyby's caps, letters, tea, forks, odd boots and shoes of children, firewood, wafers, saucepan lids, damp sugar in odds and ends of paper bags, footstools, blacklead brushes, bread, Mrs. Jellyby's bonnets, books with butter sticking to the binding, guttered candle ends put out by being turned upside down in broken candlesticks, nutshells, heads, and tails of shrimps, dinner mats, gloves, coffee grounds, umbrellas that he looked frightened, and left off again. But he came regularly every evening and sat without his coat, with his head against the wall, as though he would have helped us, if he had known how. "Poor Pa," said Caddy to me on the night before the great day, when we really had got things a little to rights. "It seems unkind to leave him, Esther. But what could I do if I stayed? Since I first knew you, I have tidied and tidied over and over again, but it's useless. Ma and Africa, together, upset the whole house directly. We never have a servant who don't drink. Ma's ruinous to everything." Mr. Jellyby could not hear what she said, but he seemed very low indeed and shed tears, I thought. "My heart aches for him, that it does," sobbed Caddy. I can't help thinking tonight, Esther, how dearly I hoped to be happy with Prince, and how dearly Pa hoped, I dare say, to be happy with Ma. What a disappointed life. My dear Caddy, said Mr. Jellyby, looking slowly round from the whale. It was the first time, I think, I ever heard him say three words together. Yes, Pa, cried Caddy, going to him, and embracing him affectionately. My dear Caddy, said Mr. Jellyby. Never have, not Prince, Pa, faltered Caddy. Not have Prince? Yes, my dear, said Mr. Jellyby. Have him, certainly. But, never have I mentioned in my account of our first visit in Thavies Inn, that Richard described Mr. Jellyby as frequently opening his mouth after dinner without saying anything. It was a habit of his. He opened his mouth now a great many times, and shook his head in a melancholy manner. What do you wish me not to have? Don't have what, dear Pa? Asked Caddy, coaxing him, with her arms round his neck. Never have a mission, my dear child. Mr. Jellyby groaned, and laid his head against the wall again, and this was the only time I ever heard him make any approach to expressing his sentiments on the Borealian question. I suppose he had been more talkative and lively once, but he seemed to have been completely exhausted long before I knew him. I thought Mrs. Jellyby never would have left off serenely looking over her papers and drinking coffee that night. It was 12 o'clock before we could obtain possession of the room, and the clearance it required then was so discouraging that Caddy, who was almost tired out, sat down in the middle of the dust and cried. But she soon cheered up, and we did wonders with it, before we went to bed. In the morning it looked, by the aid of a few flowers, and a quantity of soap and water and a little arrangement, quite gay. The plain breakfast made a cheerful show, and Caddy was perfectly charming. But when my darling came, I thought and I think now that I never had seen such a dear face as my beautiful pet's. We made a little feast for the children upstairs, and we put Peepy at the head of the table, and we showed them Caddy in her bridal dress, and they clapped their hands and hurrahed, and Caddy cried to think that she was going away from them, and hugged them over and over again until we brought Prince up to fetch her away when, I am sorry to say, Peepy bit him. Then there was old Mr. Turveydrop downstairs, in a state of deportment not to be expressed, benignly blessing Caddy and giving my guardian to understand that his son's happiness was his own parental work, and that he sacrificed personal considerations to ensure it. My dear sir, said Mr. Turveydrop, these young people will live with me. My house is large enough for their accommodation, and they shall not want the shelter of my roof. I could have wished you will understand the allusion, Mr. Jarndyce, for you remember my illustrious patron the Prince Regent. I could have wished that my son had married into a family where there was more deportment, but the will of heaven be done. Mr. and Mrs. Pardiggle were of the party. Mr. Pardiggle, an obstinate-looking man with a large waistcoat and stubbly hair, who was always talking in a loud bass voice about his might, or Mrs. Pardiggle's might, or their five boys' mites. Mr. Quail, with his hair brushed back as usual, and his knobs of temples shining very much, was also there, not in the character of a disappointed lover, but as the accepted of a young at least, an unmarried lady, a Miss Whisk, who was also there. Miss Whisk's mission, my guardian said, was to show the world that woman's mission was man's mission, and that the only genuine mission of both man and woman was to be always moving declaratory resolutions about things in general at public meetings. The guests were few, but were, as one might expect at Mrs. Jellyby's, all devoted to public objects only. Besides those I have mentioned, there was an extremely dirty lady with her bonnet all awry, and the ticketed price of her dress still sticking on it, whose neglected home, Caddy told me, was like a filthy wilderness, but whose church was like a fancy fair. A very contentious gentleman, who said it was his mission to be everybody's brother, but who appeared to be on terms of coolness with the whole of his large family, completed the party. A party, having less in common with such an occasion, could hardly have been got together by any ingenuity. Such a mean mission as the domestic mission was the very last thing to be endured among them. Indeed, Miss Wisk informed us, with great indignation, before we sat down to breakfast, that the idea of woman's mission lying chiefly in the narrow sphere of home was an outrageous slander on the part of her tyrant, man. One other singularity was that nobody with a mission except Mr. Quayle, whose mission, as I think I have formerly said, was to be in ecstasies with everybody's mission, cared at all for anybody's mission. Mrs. Pardiggle being as clear that the only one infallible course was her course of pouncing upon the poor and applying benevolence to them like a straight waistcoat, as Miss Wisk was that the only practical thing for the world was the emancipation of woman from the thraldom of her tyrant, man. Mrs. Jellyby, all the while, sat smiling at the limited vision that could see anything but Mariabulaga. But I am anticipating now the purport of our conversation on the ride home instead of first marrying Caddy. We all went to church, and Mr. Jellyby gave her away. Of the air with which old Mr. Turveydrop, with his hat under his left arm, the inside presented at the clergyman like a cannon, and his eyes creasing themselves up into his wig, stood stiff and high-shouldered behind us bridesmaids during the ceremony, and afterwards saluted us, I could never say enough to do it justice. Miss Wisk, whom I cannot report as prepossessing in appearance, and whose manner was grim, listened to the proceedings, as part of woman's wrongs, with a disdainful face. Mrs. Jellyby, with her calm smile and her bright eyes, looked the least concerned of all the company. We duly came back to breakfast, and Mrs. Jellyby sat at the head of the table, and Mr. Jellyby at the foot. Caddy had previously stolen upstairs to hug the children again and tell them that her name was Turveydrop. But this piece of information, instead of being an agreeable surprise to Peepee, threw him on his back in such transports of kicking grief that I could do nothing on being sent for but accede to the proposal that he should be admitted to the breakfast table. So he came down and sat in my lap. And Mrs. Jellyby, after saying, in reference to the state of his pinafore, "Oh, you naughty Peepee, what a shocking little pig you are," was not at all discomposed. He was very good, except that he brought down Noah with him out of an ark I had given him before we went to church, and would dip him head first into the wine glasses, and then put him in his mouth. My guardian, with his sweet temper and his quick perception and his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.